this week on Behind the Lens.
Yeah, I sit down with my son and explain to him that we got to find another school for him to go to for 1 year. That is devastating.
The widespread impact of closing schools in New Orleans. We'll talk with our education reporter about the latest in her series. Also, the city council will consider tough new restrictions on short-term rentals. And thoughts on community journalism by opinion editor Jed Horn.
There are certain kinds of columns we're not going to publish. Hate columns and all that sort of thing. There are other outlets for that garbage.
Jed has tips for aspiring columnists. I'm Tom Wright. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by Community Support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
Charter schools are publicly funded but privately run, and New Orleans is a heavy adopter of the model. It's poised to become the first major city in the nation without any traditional district-run schools. But certainly not all charter schools are making the grade. Several of them in New Orleans are closing their doors this summer. Marta Jusen spoke with parents and teachers who are already bracing for the impact.
Marta, tell me about this January meeting at Nelson Charter School.
I was invited to this meeting by Alex Lafarge. He's a parent at Nelson. And we're talking, or I'm listening to them talk about, they really wanted to keep the school open, and they were wondering what their options were. And State Representative Joe Bowie was there talking with them, too. And they were really just exploring, you know, was there a way they could fight to keep this school open? And it didn't really seem like there was. And then all of a sudden, Michelle Blauen-Williams, who is the CEO of that charter network, walked in, which I thought was kind of strange for a CEO to be showing up at a PTO meeting. She walked in, sat down, and a pastor asked her, oh, Nelson's closing. What are you going to do next year? And her answer was, well, I'm the CEO, so I'm still the CEO. And I think they were a little taken aback by that because, you know, she's going to keep her job while all these students and teachers scatter across the city.
Let's hear some of your interview now with one of those Nelson parents, Michael Jones.
None of this is helping the children. Mm-hmm. These children is being displaced, and they got to start all those. Got children going farther from their home that was closer to the school. That's right here, right now.
Right. So can you tell me about when you found out? How did you tell your son? Or
well, when I found out, when they told the parents about this, it was already done. The parents trying to undo what they already done. And to sit down with my son and explain to him that we got to find another school for you to go to for 1 year. That is devastating.
Marta, recap for us which of these F-rated charters are closing at the end of this school year.
In addition to Nelson, Fisher Academy and McDonough 32 are closing as well.
And as you've previously reported, there are four F-rated schools that are not being closed, but rather targeted for improvement. Which are those?
Landry Walker, Moton Charter, Craig, and Singleton.
Then there's Harney Academy that's closing, and you've reported their troubles in earlier podcasts. And then there's Cypress Academy. Tell me about what's going on at Cypress.
So Cypress was a charter school last year, and with 2 days left to go in the school year, their board kind of freaked out and said, there's no way we can run the school next year on this model. We're not going to have enough money to do it. So they announced the school would be closing. Parents were up in arms. The district responded to them by saying, okay, we will run the school for 2 years. But the district walked back on that promise this fall and said, actually, we're going to close Cypress at the end of the year. Superintendent Lewis has, you know, pretty much made it known that he doesn't want to directly run schools. So I think while it was a surprise to Cypress parents, it wasn't necessarily a shock to the community. But now those families are looking for new schools, too.
Okay. What sort of options do these students have in terms of where they go next?
There are 980 students in closing schools, and there are less than half that many seats at A and B schools that are open. So while there are options, they're not necessarily highly rated schools.
Obviously, for those who can't get in the A and B rated schools, they're going to lesser rated schools.
Well, yeah, the students from the F schools are hopefully going to better schools, but Cypress is a C rated school.
Tell me about some of the disruption that teachers at these closing schools have talked about with you.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of uncertainty there. Teachers at Harney had to reapply for their jobs because the district took over, so it was a new employer, essentially. Teachers know they're not going to have a job next year at this closing school, so I think, you know, there's kind of that annual scramble. Just a lot of uncertainty and insecurity, and that's what I've been hearing from teachers.
And some of these teachers are, in fact, having to look further afield than simply another school in New Orleans.
Right, and that's something that we've heard from advocates, is they think the annual contracts that teachers work on in New Orleans, generally speaking at charters, they're not an incentive to come to the city, and that people might feel more secure if they're working in Jefferson or St. Bernard parishes.
Marta Jewson, thank you very much. This is a fascinating report in your series on closing schools in New Orleans.
Thank you.
New Orleans City Planning Commission on Tuesday approved the language for a much stricter regulatory regime for short-term rentals. The amendments now go to the City Council for a final decision. Michael Isaac Stein has that.
The City Council and Councilmember Palmer had an idea of what they wanted the new short-term rental regulations to look like. But before they could actually vote on it, they needed the actual language that would be put into the comprehensive zoning ordinance. And to do that, they needed the City Planning Commission to write that up. So they voted to approve the language that had been written up by their staff. And now that goes back to City Council. The big takeaway from that meeting is now City Planning Commission's role in this is kind of done. It's basically all in the hands of the City Council now, and they have, you know, everything they need to move forward with actually changing short-term rental regulations in the city.
Okay, let's get into a couple of the gritty details. And how did this language that they approved differ than the recommendations by Councilwoman Palmer last year?
Right. So if you remember, Palmer's recommendations or Palmer's request was actually based off of a prior City Planning Commission study done in 2018. Her proposal was a little bit more permissive than the City Planning Commission proposal. And the big way that it was different, both proposals required that for a residential short-term rental, that the owner have a homestead exemption on that property. Palmer's proposal said that property owner could rent out up to 3 units on their property. So if you have a fourplex, you could live in one and rent out the 3 others. The City Planning Commission, what they approved on Tuesday, they say, you know, that's too much. That's pretty much, you know, an actual bed and breakfast at that point. So they say that you can only have 1 unit rented out per property. The other big change is that Palmer had recommended having a total ban on short-term rentals in the Garden District. The City Planning Commission did not recommend that.
What's the way forward for these proposals now?
Yeah, so now it goes back to the City Council. I'm sure they're going to discuss it. They might make, you know, some minor changes, but, you know, after, you know, almost a year of talking about this, all these procedural hurdles, we're finally at the point where City Council can act, you know, unilaterally without asking for permission or waiting for language. So this is when, you know, it starts to get interesting.
Michael, on a totally different topic, I want to ask you to describe what you're doing with WWNO now. You're doing some reporting from them.
Yeah, that's right. So The Lens is partnering with WWNO, and basically I'm going to be a split reporter between the two newsrooms, which I'm personally excited about because it lets me keep reporting on the same stuff, but presenting those, you know, same stories in 2 different ways. One is the written Lens style. One is the more, you know, narrative-driven WWNO style. So, excited about that. I think there's going to be a lot of good collaboration there.
Outstanding. Public Radio in New Orleans and The Lens. Michael Isaac Stein, thank you as always.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Many of the most popular items on our website are opinion columns, and for good reason. The Lens offers a powerful platform for stakeholders who want to debate pressing issues, both local and global. Editor Jed Horn spoke with us this week about opinion writing on The Lens.
Well, there's really two kinds of things that we do at The Lens. There's our investigative work of which we are justly proud and for which we are rewarded with the industry's highest honors. There's also our commitment to what you can call community journalism, which is to give voice to community opinion across as broad a spectrum as we can find people willing to share their views with us. And so we solicit or accept op-ed pieces, opinion columns on topics of the day. There are certain kinds of columns we're not going to publish, hate columns and all that sort of thing. There are other outlets for that garbage. But we are very happy to find people able and willing to talk about the issues in their community, talk about citywide issues, glance the national perspective as needed or appropriate. And it's been a huge broadening of the Lens's scope and reach and of our readership.
What makes for a good opinion column? In your view, and this is your opinion on opinion column.
My opinion on the opinion column is that the best ones have a couple of different attributes. One is that they are sharply focused on perhaps as little as a single idea, although we can be expansive as need be to provide context. Another is that they be in a natural tone of voice, if you will. We don't need scholarship. We don't the scholarly tone of writing. What we want is a conversational interaction between the column writer and our audience. And I think if you think as you sit down to write a good opinion column, if you think of yourself as talking to an intelligent pal, a friend, a sibling, your mom, you're likely to come away with a much more engaging and convincing piece of work. And my final warning, often observed in the breach, is that they not go on forever. I usually recommend 1,000 words. And they certainly, and indeed most often, run beyond that. But to the extent that they get much too long, they lose focus. And focus is very important in the arts of persuasion.
From my perspective, you know, coming to The Lens from a commercial media background, I've always been impressed by our ability to offer that forum for community views. And I'd ask if you had two or three columns that stand out as examples of what you're talking about here.
Well, let me mention that there have really been two categories of contributors to our opinion columns. We hear from the big shots across the spectrum. Malcolm Suber has contributed. City council members have contributed. John Barry, who was a very central part of the post-Katrina sort of analysis of what went so very wrong, has contributed. Derwin Bunton, who ran the Indigent Defender Service in the city. Lola Zeli has been with us. Those are people of some prominence, names that draw people into our readership. But equally important to what we do are those who come forward from anonymous backgrounds, or they may be known only within their community. And they want us to be acquainted with an issue of particular concern in that community. And my further goal is to try to get as broad a spectrum as possible of political orientations into play. We've recently, let's be honest, a lot of people who read The Lens are of the liberal or progressive persuasion. That means that part of my job is trying to find people who are able to pop that bubble convincingly and intelligently, conservatives in short. And we've had some very interesting ones. We've had, a column that attacked, if you will, the Israeli relationship to the to Palestinians, and in the course of doing so, this being a hyper-local outlet, the Lens, they attacked mainstream Jewish organizations who were in support of Donald Trump's enthusiasm for Benjamin Netanyahu and that kind of thing. Believe me, we then heard from Jewish Federation people, others who found our coverage revolting, who told us we were anti-Semitic and all of that. You know, one winces and then publishes those comments anyway, even though I think they were better directed at the authors of the column than at the website that chose to publish them. But that kind of interaction, anonymous people speaking in very raw terms about issues of the day that affect their lives are important. We recently had a column, in fact, it's still on the homepage, by a self-described Southern Baptist conservative young guy, Marcus Maldonado by name, who came out, as many other conservatives have, but you might not know this, in urging that the death penalty be made illegal in Louisiana, that it no longer be part of our repertoire of criminal sanctions. And I think I was very glad to have that piece because it popped a bubble. It popped a bubble where we can become very complacent as left liberals or progressives or mainstream thinkers, or call us what you will, that we are the only ones who are thinking these issues through intelligently. And that's simply not true. So we look for opinion all across the spectrum. And in that sense, you know, the Lens was citizen journalism, if you will, particularly in the age of opinion journalism, which this has become, is a very important part of the Lens DNA. We were founded by a woman, Karen Gadbois, who had never before really been a journalist, but out of outrage over what she saw after Katrina and fascination, if you will, with the levers of power as she saw them being manipulated and abused, went after some of the recovery programs, saw housing being destroyed that shouldn't have been destroyed, saw graft, saw corruption, and ultimately won some of the highest honors in the industry in collaboration with Lee Zurich over at the TV station. And we do a lot of collaboration, I should hasten to add. In any case, that's a legacy. Karen is still with us, so I needn't call it a legacy, but it's part of what we do and do with great pride, which is to find people rooted in their communities and capable of opinion that others will value or at least sit up and take note of. I should add that we always are available to help first-timers or amateurs, if you will, to shape their views. We offer editorial suggestions, never mandates, almost always are able to find an accommodation with a writer that we think is shooting him or herself in the foot and help them perfect a column that will be a meaningful contribution to our readership and to the Lens.
Any final tips for people who, if they're ready to do some writing for the Lens?
Get in touch. Call us up. Send me an email. I'm much more easily reached by email. jedhorn@gmail.com is the very simplest way to do it. Or contact Karen Gadbois, kgadbois@thelensnola.org. And she kind of sifts through the suggestions that we get and helps me contact people from whom we want to hear. And we are wide open to your suggestions and your community's sense of what's urgent, what needs to happen. I'll say one final thing. When we get in touch with the public, often it's because they are complaining we haven't covered this, that, or the other thing. We can only cover so much. We have a limited size staff here, like any publication does. And so my response, and I'm quite sincere, is, yeah, you're right. That's an issue we should cover, and no one is better able to cover it than yourself. Write us that opinion column in which you set out the terms of the discussion that should be happening on our homepage, and you'll be leading the pack in that conversation.
The community is what makes community journalism work. Jed Horn, the Lens editor, thank you very much for coming in.
Certainly. Thanks so much, Tom.
We want to remind you that your support makes this podcast and our website possible. Consider making a donation today. Go to support.thelensnola.org. I'm Tom Wright. Thank you for getting behind the lens.